Today's edition of the Daily Caller podcast is brought to you by Life Change Tea.
Why go to getthetea.com? Because this important news could change your life. Socrates made a statement saying that all disease starts in the gut. Take care of your gut, and well, the rest speaks for itself. Life Change Tea is a wonderful way to aid in your digestion. Brew it, steep it, drink it, and feel it go to work. We at Life Change Tea have been around for years helping people just like you feel better. Lots of testimonials and lots of happy people. Log on to getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. Getthetea.com.
Alrighty, hello again everyone and welcome to it. It's the Daily Caller podcast for the 3rd of May 2020. Good Lord. One of these days, you know, I didn't screw up at all in January, I don't think. Maybe once or twice. But, you know, behold the ravages of age. Welcome to the show. It's 2020, in case you were just scrambling to grab a calendar, and in case you still use a calendar. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host. Welcome to the program. It's Super Tuesday. Happy Tuesday, Super Duper Tuesday to you, or as Joe Biden calls it, Super Thursday. Super day that ends in Y. Who am I and why am I here? Oh, Joe. Things are starting to come up roses for Joe Biden. Of course, some roses do smell like poop. We'll see how it works out for sniffy, grabby, gropey Uncle Joe as he, in a Michael Corleone way, but with Fredo's IQ, manages to consolidate the Democratic Party behind his bid to win their nomination. What an interesting day it has been. What a rare mood I'm in. It's almost like being in love, but not with Joe Biden. Good Lord. We got a lot to get to today. Chris Matthews called it quits on hardball. He was fired. No matter what anybody tells you, he was fired. He has been targeted for a while for not being pure enough because, as I've told you, if you are their 0.1% enemy, you are their 100% enemy on the left. Frankenstein's monster always comes back to the castle to destroy. All right. Like I said, there's a lot of stuff. If you want to enter to win a signed copy of Yuval Levin's book, email me, Derek@dailycaller.com, as many of you have. You have all been entered, I assure you. There are just too many of you for me to respond to everybody individually. And I'll do that. You have until... I'm going to say you have... We're going to make it a little bit later this week. You have until 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Thursday to enter. That's right. I've already recorded this week's interview, so I can tell you who it's with. It's with Matt Walsh, who does the Matt Walsh podcast. He has a book out called Church of Cowards, and we talked to him last week, and we're using it this week, so there you go. There's no chance of it falling apart. Technical issues or any... Well, I guess I shouldn't say that, because they could... Like, the hard drive it's stored on could crash. Oh, man, I just probably screwed myself. Oh, well. There'll be signed copies of his book in any event to give away next week. Don't even try to enter this week. I'm not going to entertain that. It's Yuval Levin week. So email me if you want to get a chance to win a signed copy of Yuval Levin's book, and you shall be entered. Okay, let's give a hat tip to our sponsor, Life Change Tea. Life Change Tea. You go to getthetea.com. Look, if you're dragging, if you're not feeling right, if you just feel like you're slow, your energy's not out there, it's probably, or partially at least, because you've got a whole bunch of gunk inside of you that is preventing your body from absorbing all of the good nutrition that it otherwise would absorb from the food you're consuming. That's right. You need to clean yourself out every once in a while. Now, you can go in the one way, or you can go in the way that Life Change Tea does it, and make sure that it cleans you out on the way out. You don't necessarily want to go the other way. It's a bit of a pain in the to go that way. So you get Life Change Tea. You just drink a cup a day, and it is the tea that makes you go. It will clean you out, and suddenly you will find that you have more energy because the nutrition in the food you're consuming will be, it'll be absorbed, shall we say. Don't overdo it. Don't chug the whole thing. Do not do that. Drink as directed. and you will see a difference. You get a 30-day supply. You just go to getthetea.com, enter promo code Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at checkout. Click apply. You get great discounts. You can't beat it. You support them. You support the show, and you support yourself. And we thank them, and we thank you. All right. So in a move very reminiscent of The Godfather, if Fredo were the chosen one, Joe Biden has managed, he didn't do it, it was the Democratic establishment, has managed to unite the entirety of the party structure, except for Elizabeth Warren, who knows what the hell she's doing, but she's so insignificant on her own that she's likely to lose Massachusetts in the primary. He's managed to get out Buttigieg, Tom Steyer, and Amy Klobuchar. Now, why? These people were in it to win it. And like I said yesterday, there is no strategic gain for anybody to dropping out the day or 2 days before Super Tuesday. It's already, your name is on the ballot. Early voting has already happened for hundreds of thousands of people in all of those states. You're not going to be able to swing enough votes to swing the vote anywhere. I can't imagine that you possibly could. Nobody can go back and change their vote. If you voted for Amy Klobuchar because you were really drunk when you voted, your vote is cast for Amy Klobuchar. The second you put your ballot in the box, it's over. Bye. So what are they hoping to accomplish? Well, they're hoping to accomplish in the future. They're hoping to put forth a united front for the people who are voting today and for future primaries, because they still come pretty bing, bang, boom, one after the other. And they want, I don't think anybody actually wants Joe Biden. They don't want Bernie. And it's kind of, it doesn't bode well for Democrats, at least as of now. Maybe Joe can stir up some excitement. I doubt it, but it's possible that Joe can stir up some excitement before the end of the primary and if he gets the nomination. But being the guy who isn't the guy you didn't want to vote for is not really going to look really good on bumper stickers, if you know what I mean. It just isn't a catchy thing. Nobody is inspired. I am going to go trudge through snow and rain and sleet and cold weather in November because the guy I sort of wanted or settled for because I didn't want the other guy is on the ballot against Donald Trump. Democrats are hoping that the first part will be forgotten there and the against Donald Trump part will be the only part that registers. Maybe it will. I don't know. Maybe it will. But it seems unlikely to me because I just don't see Joe Biden exciting anybody. Right now, after one primary victory, three runs for president, Joe Biden has been participating so far in his running for president career. He's been involved in five primaries, and he's won one of them. He's batting 200. He's a light-hitting utility infielder who will be sent back down to the minors after the 250 hitter comes off the 10-day disabled list, or whatever they call the disabled list now because political correctness is ruining everything. Joe Biden is not an inspirational winner. He is not an inspirational candidate. Say what you will about Donald Trump. A lot of people voted for Donald Trump, myself included, because I wanted to at least register my disgust at President Hillary Clinton. I voted fully expecting Hillary Clinton to win. I live in Maryland. She was going to win, and she easily won my state. But I wanted to go to the polls so that I knew, at least I knew, that I had done everything I could do to say, I do not support this woman. I oppose this woman. And it just turns out that there were a lot of people like me who went to the polls and said, not Hillary, never going to do it. And Donald Trump won. I was as shocked as I suspect he was that night. But Donald Trump inspired a lot of people, even though I didn't think he stood a chance in winning. I enjoyed his speeches. I would watch those rallies. They were hilarious. The debate performances, I'd watch it and I'd find myself occasionally going, hell yeah, let's do this. Because we've all kind of, I assume, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I for a long time had that fantasy or that thought of, Why doesn't a candidate just come out and tell these people to get bent? Why doesn't a candidate just come out and call a spade a spade? Why don't they just really come out and tell the unvarnished truth that it really, before Donald Trump, only ever existed in our heads and in occasional Hollywood movies? Like, what was that? Bullworth. Remember that awful, I guess it's not awful, that Warren Beatty movie where he thinks he's dying and he hires a hitman, he's a United States senator, he hires a hitman to take him out so his family or whatever can get any insurance money, and he just, in his final days, he says, to hell with it, I'm just going to tell the truth, I'm going to go into it, I'm going to go nonstop, and he is just brutally honest with everybody, and he becomes wildly popular because of it, and then he doesn't want to die, and it turns out he's not really dying, whatever, so on and so forth. The rest of the plot doesn't matter. But the point is that somebody like Donald Trump had only ever existed in the movies. And you watch that and you go, yeah, I get that. That is, if people actually were like that, if candidates were actually like that, if politicians were like that, they'd be wildly popular because, and the reason you have that thought is because we're sick of being lied to. We're sick of being pandered to. We're sick of being condescended to. And Donald Trump came along and didn't do any of that. He just told you how it was. He told it how it was, and he called out all the BS and all the garbage and all the people slinging the BS and all the people slinging the garbage and all the people who were promising you're going to do this, that, and the other thing. And it makes you wonder, well, if you're going to do these things, why haven't you done them yet? Why haven't you introduced any legislation to do this? Why haven't, if you're so into this, why haven't you done it yet? And that sort of thing. And then he was, of course, very blunt. And when he got rude questions, he was rude right back to them, things like that. People appreciated that. That spoke to people. Joe Biden doesn't inspire that in anybody. He doesn't inspire anybody, except for maybe Hunter, to get really creative in his job searches. So even if the Democrats manage to, and I think just looking at the numbers and looking at the way the map is and the screwed up way that Democrats allocate the delegates, it looks like the best that they can hope for is a brokered convention. Maybe something will change. I mean, it's mathematically possible that either Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden could win outright at this point, but it's just not likely, and especially if Michael Bloomberg sticks around. That actually, when you think about Super Tuesday, what happens on the day after Super Tuesday, boring Wednesday, with Michael Bloomberg is probably the most important thing for all of this plan by the Democratic establishment to try and get Bernie Sanders to lose. Because if Michael Bloomberg sticks around, if Michael Bloomberg doesn't win anything today, or doesn't barely wins any delegates, or even possibly doesn't win any delegates at all, it's entirely possible that he will have spent $500 million and come up with nothing. The question is, well, will he then get out of the race? Because you got to get 15% in a state. If you get 15% in one of the states, you get some delegates. So maybe Bloomberg gets, you know, a couple of delegates here, or maybe he gets a bunch of delegates. Who knows? But if he doesn't get anything, he has a choice to make. Does he stay in to try to finagle or at least have a say in a brokered convention? Maybe come away with a nomination? Unlikely, but maybe. Or does he say, we've got to stop Bernie, I'm going to get out and endorse Joe Biden like Klobuchar and Buttigieg did? It'll be kind of difficult for Bloomberg to do that for one very important reason. Michael Bloomberg, before all of this mess started, six months ago or whatever, when there was first speculation that Michael Bloomberg might run for president, he said he wasn't going to run if Joe Biden ran. That was his rationale. That's why he didn't get into until very late. He was a Joe Biden fan. Once he saw Joe Biden on the campaign trail, he realized that Joe Biden was a horrible candidate, and Joe Biden cannot beat Donald Trump, according to Michael Bloomberg. So he felt compelled to enter. Now, I agree with him on the assessment of Joe Biden. I don't agree with the assessment, his own assessment, that he could be the one to beat Donald Trump. He's actually about equally as uninspiring as Joe Biden is as a candidate, if we're being perfectly honest. But if, Michael Bloomberg, since you're paying everybody on the planet, you want to throw some money my way, I could probably say some nice things about you on the podcast and not feel like I was going to rot in hell for the rest of my life. But no, he wasn't going to get in. He didn't get in the race because he said Joe Biden's in there. He thought that that middle lane for sort of semi-sane, as they describe it, as what's, you know, sane to a liberal, moderate Democrat, was there. And if Joe Biden was going to fill it, Michael Bloomberg was going to defer to that. Well, Michael Bloomberg got in, saying that Joe Biden can't win. So if Michael Bloomberg drops out and then says Joe Biden can win, then why in the hell did you get in the first place? What were you thinking? What's going on? Why did you do this? Well, of course, the truth is that Michael Bloomberg watched Joe Biden on the campaign trail and saw him make gaffe after gaffe after gaffe while we've laughed at it hysterically. While it's been ridiculous to watch, it becomes mildly terrifying when you realize that the entire party's power structure is throwing its weight behind this guy, which means that the choice for the Democrats is likely to come down to a communist or somebody suffering early onset dementia. Actually, it's not all that early. That's the best of the Democratic Party. I've said it before. I'll say it again because it's appropriate, and there's an inappropriate piece of word here. So you've been warned. The cream rises to the top, but sometimes shit floats too. And that's pretty much the Democratic primary right now. Yesterday, I said, I told you Mayor Pete dropped out. Today, Amy Klobuchar dropped out. I don't understand why Amy Klobuchar dropped out. I don't understand why Mayor Pete dropped out, except for that the Democratic Party's power structure went in and said, you guys need to get out. We need you to get out. We have to stop Bernie Sanders. And they acquiesced. Now, why would you ask? Why would somebody drop out? Why would somebody take the power structure at their word, do and bow to their will? Well, it's mostly because of horse trading. You think that in politics, the people who are on the ground in the grassroots and the people who are excited, people who listen to this podcast and other podcasts, are very, they believe in what they believe. It's not paying lip service. It's not pretending. They actually believe this stuff. We actually believe in this stuff. And we find a candidate who is closest to what we believe. The people who are the candidates, they don't necessarily believe in it. They believe that they're the person to lead the country, and they're willing to say and do anything to get the votes. That's where they lose their minds, where they do anything for power. And when you are a marginal candidate at best, although I would say that Pete was more than a marginal candidate, but when you're a marginal candidate at best, but you have some support, you have some power, and you can either try and ride that power to the end, which would piss off people. Elizabeth Warren, I don't think, is going to get anything because she's stuck in this thing far too long, way past when she should have. But if you're willing to play the game and give up your dream, at least for now, and say, I will drop out and endorse you in exchange for consideration of either being your running mate, but neither Buttigieg or Klobuchar are going to be running mates. Pete's a man, even though he's gay, that doesn't check enough boxes for the Democrats. And Klobuchar is a woman, but she's white, so being a woman doesn't check enough boxes for Democrats. So they're not going to be VP, but they could be a cabinet position. They could be, you know, promised if Biden doesn't work out, you're going to get a little bit of favor, a little bit of sunshine thrown on your way in 2024 when you try again for the Democratic nomination. But it's likely that they were promised some kind of cabinet secretary. Plus, Mayor Pete needs a job. Mayor Pete is out of work as of the first of the year. Maybe there's a future for him as head of the DNC, for example. Maybe there's a future for him as a cable news pundit, because if you don't think that the party is coordinating with the cable news pundits and the cable news bookers and all of that stuff, you're crazy. So there are a lot of things. There's a lot of horse trading going around. I just find it interesting that Elizabeth Warren is still in this. She literally has no chance whatsoever of winning the nomination. And the longer she stays in, she literally has, and I'm using literally far too often, but I mean it literally, she has no chance of being a power broker at the Democratic convention. And she will not be tapped for something if she stays in past today, past, well, tomorrow, tonight, really. If she overstays her welcome even more than she has, she will have tarnished her record. It's not like Bernie Sanders in 2016. Bernie Sanders was racking up wins in the Democratic primary, and he took that primary deep into the summer. Because there was a realistic chance, long shot as it was, the later it got, there was a realistic chance that he could win the nomination. Once he realized he couldn't, once it was mathematically done, he dropped out. Elizabeth Warren is already mathematically done. She's just over. She's got no delegates. She's got nothing to show for her efforts. That's a bitter pill to swallow, but mature adults swallow that pill all the time in politics. So whatever it is that's going on in her head, or maybe, I don't know, maybe she thinks that staying in is somehow helping Bernie Sanders. She did spend most of her time attacking Michael Bloomberg. Now, will she, if she makes it to the next debate, will she attack Joe Biden? Will she attack Bernie Sanders? Will she be around for it? I don't know. She's got one chip. She can cash it in somewhere. The thing is, she can cash it in with Biden or she can cash it in with Bernie. She can't cash it in with both. So which way will she go? That is going to be one to watch. As the party power structure was coalescing and working behind the scenes to make sure that Joe Biden, you know, was the front runner, was put up there almost completely unfettered in, they can't buy off Bloomberg. Bloomberg doesn't want a job. Bloomberg isn't going to accept a cabinet post. Maybe he will later on, but he doesn't need it. He's got, you know, $60 billion. What the hell does he care? And Elizabeth Warren is just insane. She thinks she can still win, even though she can't. While they were doing that, and this is kind of funny because all of this was precipitated by the win on Saturday in South Carolina. Now, it's a big win in South Carolina. You got almost 50% of the vote to Bernie's 20%, almost 20% of the vote. He more than doubled and then halved up again Bernie Sanders, which is a big victory. It is one victory out of five times over 32 years, three runs for the presidency. Joe Biden racks up a victory and the party swoops in and says, "Woo, we got him. All right, we've got to consolidate. He's proven he can win. Let's capitalize on this momentum. Let's try and get everybody out. We'll offer them anything they want. We'll do whatever we can." While they're trying because of one, they're getting in line behind him because of one victory. They want to coalesce around him because of one victory. They should have waited to coalesce around him until he strung together one coherent sentence. Because Joe Biden can't do that, as he proved today. In addition to saying that tomorrow, meaning he was speaking yesterday, saying that tomorrow is Super Thursday, forgetting the day of the week. He's forgotten the city he was in. He's forgotten the state he was in. And now he's forgotten what day of the week Super Tuesday falls on. He also forgot the Declaration of Independence and the words to the Declaration of Independence. This is another one of those moments I talk about when I talk about dementia and Joe Biden. He's not all there. I don't take any pleasure in pointing out that he's not all there, but he's not all there. He doesn't catch his mistakes. He can't acknowledge his mistakes. You can't acknowledge what you can't catch. And if you're not catching your mistakes, your gaffes, your screw-ups, you're oblivious to them, which is a sign that all is not well in the Gray Matterville. Listen to Joe Biden in Texas yesterday, trying to quote the Declaration of Independence and failing miserably.
It's time for America to get back up on its feet and once again fight for the proposition that we hold these truths to be self-evident. Sounds corny. Not a joke. Think about it. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men and women created by you know the thing. You know how we talk about it. Are we the people, folks, endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights? We've never lived up to that. We've never lived up to that. Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the words, never lived up to it. But we've never, ever before walked away from it. Never.
You want to talk about confusion. You want to talk about delusion. Right there is your Democratic Party's choice to be their nominee for president. This kind of lets you know just how god-awful bad Bernie Sanders is in their eyes. How terrified they are of Bernie Sanders. But Joe Biden right there, you know, says, men and women created equal, and all that other stuff, and those guys and such and whatever, and we the people. He's confusing the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States, which was not written by Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was in Paris at the time. That starts off, we the people. Thomas Jefferson wrote that we were endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is not in the Constitution. He kind of conflated. He got very, very confused. And the crowd around him is going, what? What? Huh? Who? How? Huh? This is the guy the Democrats think can beat Donald Trump? This is the guy? They think he's got a better shot than Bernie does. It's a testament to just how weak their bench is. But it really, it lets you know how terrified the party structure is of Bernie Sanders being the nominee. Well, here's something that I've said before, and advice I had given Joe Biden's campaign when I thought that Joe Biden could, I didn't think they were ever going to listen, but I thought that I didn't realize how senile Joe Biden had gotten. The party could have easily marginalized Bernie Sanders. How? They could have stood up to him. They could have put somebody up there strategically. God knows they had enough people up there. At one point, there were like 24 different candidates. They could have put somebody up there viable to say, enough. We are not communists. We are not socialists. We are not going to go in that direction. This is ridiculous. We have to. Not everybody who opposes us is awful. Not everybody who disagrees with us is a racist, a sexist, a homophobe, a transphobe, a triskaidekaphobe, a thisaphobe, a thataphobe. It's just not true. And we need to stop demonizing people who disagree with us. We're all Americans and we're all in this together. None of them could bring themselves to do that. Now, the one who could do that most credibly was Joe Biden. But instead, just like everybody else in the field, Joe Biden chose to ape 90% of what Bernie Sanders had been saying. He tried to co-opt Bernie's stances and Bernie's positions and Bernie's place in the party rather than try to defeat it, rather than try to convince the party. I'm still convinced, as crazy as I think Democrats are, that there is a large vein in the Democratic Party's mind that is not a lunatic left vein. That vein had nobody. That strain of party, that lane, vein, strain, however you want to put it, that part of the party had nobody to go to. No one to go to. Joe Biden is the closest thing to go to it, but it's all based upon what Joe Biden has said in the past, a past he has spent this entire primary season denouncing and apologizing for. I wrote the crime bill. Yeah, sorry about writing the crime bill. I did this bill and that bill and the other bill. And sorry about those bills. My apologies for all the people that those bills put in prison. You're never going to win with that kind of attitude, with that kind of candidate that just doesn't believe it distances themselves from their past. The one thing Bernie has going for him, to the extent that he appeals to anybody who isn't absolutely batshit crazy, is that he's wildly consistent. He believes what he believed since he was 15 years old and a young communist rooting for the Soviet Union during the Cold War. That's who he's always been. That's who he'll always be. Most people would look at that, sane people would look at that and go, that guy has no ability to learn, no ability to change, no ability to grow or adapt. But other people look at that, if you're inclined on the left, and you go, well, at least he's consistent. I don't feel like he's lying to me, because, you know, he's not lying to them. But on a bigger picture front, when you're dealing with a guy who's batshit crazy as your nominee versus somebody who's just BSing you all the time, what are your options? Do you want the crazy guy whose policies you think are nuts but will likely never be enacted, or the guy who's literally losing his marbles right in front of you? I don't know the answer to that. Thank God we don't have that choice in front of us. But if somebody had stood up to Bernie and really stood up to the AOC wing of the party, oh, they would have caught some hell. They would have caught some major hell. My God, the hell they would have caught from a very vocal, extremely vocal minority of the country. They could have appealed to people who are Democrats or who are moderates who don't like the president. Now, the president's approval rating is right around the high 40s, so there isn't a large swath of the country to convince, but they could have gotten them. Instead, they decided to try and bite into Bernie's pie, and Bernie doesn't like to share. At least he doesn't like to share his own stuff. The Washington Free Beacon has an op-ed about Bernie's past and his opinions on charity. Its title is Bernie Sanders' War on Charities. Starts off, in 1981, when Bernie Sanders was serving as mayor of Burlington, Vermont, from the current frontrunner for the Democratic presidential, Democratic presidential nomination, shocked the crowd gathered to kick off the annual Chittenden County fundraising drive for the United Way when he declared, quote, "I don't believe in charities." End quote. The mayor, according to a New York Times account, went on to take issue with, quote, "the fundamental concepts on which charities are based," end quote, asserting that government should instead be the provider of social services. You can see this is actually the sentiments of the Democratic Party. They just don't come out and say it. What was then a fringe view in a country that would give more than $400 billion to charity in 2018 would take on the force of tax law were a Sanders administration to prevail. That's thanks to the candidate's proposal to hike tax rates on the affluent and, crucially, to impose for the first time a tax on assets, a wealth tax, in addition to one on income. The combination would deeply wound charitable and philanthropic giving, which is dominated by the well-off. It would not only leave less income for potential charitable gifts, but would also tax wealth that has been pledged but not yet transferred to foundations, universities, and any other nonprofit organization. Like so many other Sanders proposals, it would make the United States more look like Western Europe, where charitable giving, as in Germany, is less than a third of what it is here. And its premise of false equivalency, that government can and would do the same things and do them as well as charitably funded civil society. This is the problem. This is to the left, paying taxes is charity. That's why when you look at their tax returns, when they don't think the public is looking, so when they release like 10 years of tax returns and you go back and you look and you see that Biden's gave like 0.1% of their income to charity, that Bernie Sanders gave next to nothing literally to charity for years, and then suddenly he thought about running for president. And he said, I guess I got to give something to charity so it doesn't look like I'm such a tightwad. Well, the reason that they all do that, remember, Beto O'Rourke married the daughter of a billionaire. He already came from a family with a lot of money, and they gave next to nothing to charity. Beto's answer was basically that his existence and his work in government was charity work. Well, no, he was paid handsomely for his work in government for the short time that he was there. That wasn't charitable work. That was a job. But I guess you can look at a job that pays you $170,000+ a year as charity when you marry a daughter of a billionaire and you come from a lot of money yourself. This is how the mindset works. This is what the government has been doing since the advent of the Great Society. It's what they've been trying to do since before the Great Society. It just took them until the Great Society to be able to actually do it. They want to supplant the private sector in any way, shape, or form with government. They just do. So when before the Great Society, people were not starving to death on the streets, people were not starving to death in their homes, churches and civic organizations and neighbors, back when community meant the geographic location around you, not somebody who shares some irrelevant characteristic as you, they would take care of people in need. Your neighbor needed help, you know, they're having a rough time. People actually talked to their neighbors back then. So you would go and you would help them. Oh, you're having a rough time? Well, here, I made a casserole. Why don't you have it? I accidentally made an extra casserole. There are always some kind of excuses attached to it. The soup kitchen was there without judgment. The Kiwanis clubs and the Eagles clubs and all those other kind of clubs, they were there without judgment. Then the government came in and said, oh, we can do that too, and we can do it better. Well, they haven't done it better. And actually, they've begun to rip the fabric of society apart. They began to destroy the community. And then, because you have to destroy it, they've then since been able to redefine what it means. None of this was by accident. It's right out of the communist theory. Government is the provider of all things good, not the private sector, certainly not capitalism. And so it's not surprising that Bernie said in 1981, I don't believe in charities. He opposes charities. He hates them. The left hates them. They don't give to charities because they view paying their taxes as charities. It is really... it's a perverted worldview. It's a disturbing worldview. And it's part of the reason why they're all proposing their own version of government-provided child care. And let's start school at age 3 instead of age 5. They want people, children, to grow up thinking that good things come from government. That's why they're providing school lunches and school breakfasts. And it's not based on need. It's just, well, you can't let people know who the poor kids are by giving them free school lunches and free school breakfasts. So you have to give everybody free school lunches and free school breakfasts. That way, nobody knows who needs it and who doesn't. But they also get in the back of their minds that it's the government that provides meals, not the parents. My mom made sure she didn't make me bacon and eggs every morning. She never made me bacon and eggs any morning, except on weekends. But during the week, it was make sure you're up, eat a bowl of cereal, get ready. I've made your lunch. One day a week, I was given like a dollar, whatever it was, for a school lunch. And that was it. It was just one day a week. Whatever day of the week I wanted, but it was one day a week. I remember elementary school, Fridays was the best day because it was grilled cheese, a bowl of tomato soup, and what they called a Big Dipper, which was essentially peanut butter, maybe with some Rice Krispies in it, and a thin layer of chocolate over the top of it, these little squares. They'd make giant trays of them, and they were all cut up unevenly. And you always wanted a big, big dipper, because sometimes you get screwed if they cut the lines wrong, and it's just, you know, you got a small slice of Big Dipper. But that was the day I wanted to buy lunch most of the time, because I love grilled cheese, I love tomato soup, and I loved the Big Dipper. It was great. Whatever it costs, I had enough money for that plate and a milk. I've always loved milk. But that was it. Now, if it was free lunch every day, so I don't know, maybe we could have qualified for free or reduced lunches. I have no idea. I know that my parents never did it and would never have done it. I know that the price that was on the sign was the price that I paid, so it wasn't free lunch. I'd see the kids come up and say free, and they'd give their name, and they'd get their name checked off a list. And nobody went up to them and said, you got a free lunch. You suck. Your parents are losers. That we picked on everybody for all kinds of reasons, but we didn't really understand economics at the time, so we didn't think to say, you guys are poor. We probably would have had it occurred to us, but it wouldn't have mattered, and it would have been just one of many arrows in the quiver. Nowadays, everybody gets a free lunch, so you don't know who's poor. You just can't point that out because you wouldn't want to lunch shame people. You wouldn't want to food shame anybody. You don't want to shame anybody or anything. A little bit of shame actually goes a really long way. If you grow up poor or without a lot of money, you should know that there are other people out there who do have more money. And if that is of interest to you, to live with more money, to earn more money, then you have to learn that there's a pathway to do that. And it ain't dicking around in class. It ain't screwing around in school. It ain't skipping school. It ain't doing drugs. Unless you're Barack Obama, then apparently you can join the Choom Gang and get into the most prestigious universities in the country. But instead, the left has removed all of that. And now, instead of kids being sent to lunch or sent to school with lunches, I remember it was a brown paper bag. I had to, if it was in good enough shape, I had to bring the brown paper bag back home so it could be used again, because brown paper bags weren't free. They weren't cheap. They would have my initial on it, just the D, because all of my siblings had their own brown paper bags, and you'd go to lunch, you'd go to school, you had your lunch. It was a sandwich and some kind of snack, some kind of dessert or whatever, very plain. It was like a Hostess cupcake or a Ho-Ho or a Twinkie. That was it. It was a sandwich wrapped in wax paper and some sort of Hostess thing. I always wanted the apple pie. Rarely we'd go to the Hostess outlet back before Hostess went out of business. We'd go to the Hostess outlet and we could occasionally finagle some apple pies out of my mom and get those in our lunches. And the best thing about the apple pie, I haven't tried an apple pie since Hostess went bankrupt and then was reconstituted and whatever the hell they are now. The packaging's all different. It just feels different. Plus, Lord knows I got weight to lose. I don't need to eat that crap. But the little nubbin of the crust on the corners of the Hostess apple pies. I don't know what you could, I would just eat that. I would be content to take bites off of both ends, just that little nubbin part, and you could have the rest of the pie. The rest of the pie was great too. There's something about that little corner nubbin things at the end that were awesome. But that was it. Now, you know, and I tell you that my mom made lunch for me and my siblings every single day. And my mom was disabled. My mom lost her right leg when I was a kid due to arteriosclerosis. She had health problems my whole life, virtually. That she did that with massive phantom pains and walking around hobbling. It was above the knee, so it was never easy for her to walk very far with an artificial leg. She used crutches. That she made a point of making lunch for us every day, let us know that she loved us, that she cared enough to do that. And now the government, in the name of tolerance and in the name of making sure that children never feel any kind of shame or anything but unjustified, unbridled pride, is taking that away from students. That their parents, they don't have to. And, even decent parents, if somebody says, we're going to do this every day, don't worry about fixing them breakfast, don't worry about fixing them lunch, we got you covered. Well, for a while, I bet parents would say, well, you know, I'm still going to do it. I like doing it. I want to make sure I know what my kids are eating. Then you get to the point where you're just like really tired one day and you don't do it. And so, well, they can eat the school food tomorrow. And then it becomes more and more frequent. And I bet that even some of the best parents fall into that trap. Now, the parents think, well, this is really convenient for me. But what the kid is learning is that good things come from government, that the government takes care of them, not their parents. Don't look to family. Don't look to civic organizations. Don't look to churches. Look to government to help them. And that's why if they start, school starts at age 3, if you want pre-K and everybody's there, it's just glorified daycare. My children will not take part in that ever. I'm already thinking about homeschooling them because I don't want them infected with all this, watching all of these drag queen story times. I got nothing against drag queens. If you want to be a drag queen, knock yourself out. You shouldn't be, dancing and twerking in front of 5-year-olds. You're a sick person if you do that, if that's how you get off or if you think that's appropriate. The video that's circulating now, I swear to God, I'd go up and I'd just deck the dude. If somebody started doing that in front of my kids, trying to teach them how to twerk, you can go to hell, and I'll go to prison. I don't care. You're not doing that to my kid. Anyway, that's the way that the left views charity. That's the way Bernie views charity. It is the government's job to do those things, not the other way around. It's a sick perversion of the American spirit in so much as it is allowed to exist anymore. Speaking of the American spirit in so much as it's allowed to exist anymore, the coronavirus situation continues. I believe the number is now is like 6 dead, all sort of from a nursing home community up in Washington State. Again, sticking with the narrative that elderly people with respiratory problems are most susceptible and most at risk for death from coronavirus, just like they are with the flu, which has killed, 10, 20, 50, 100 times more people so far this year than coronavirus. But the argument is still going around that the Republicans are the ones politicizing this, that, as Oliver Darcy said, the Cabbage Patch Baby on CNN said, it's the only people politicizing the coronavirus are on Fox News. And that's, well, our good friends at Grabian, which is a great website, they put together a little montage of Democrats doing what? Doing exactly what they say is only happening on Fox News. Now, what you're about to hear, this montage, none of it occurred on Fox News. Not a single bit of it. So remember that as you hear Democrat after Democrat after Democrat politicizing, using coronavirus to attack President Trump, to use it as a political weapon, while little Ollie Darcy and Brooke Baldwin over at CNN assure their audience that it is not happening. And to the extent that it happens at all, it is only on Fox News. Here's this montage from Grabian.
We have a crisis of coronavirus, and President Trump has no plan.
What he's doing is late, too late, anemic.
Mr. Trump is late.
As soon as this virus started cropping up elsewhere in the world, we should have been on top of it.
Do you trust, and should Americans trust, President Trump to deal with this crisis?
No.
This is an administration that does not believe in science, and so I'm not surprised that he's completely clueless.
Look, the president we know is not a scientist, and that's a nice way to put it. He doesn't even believe in science.
This president hasn't allowed his scientists to speak. The idea that the experts are not allowed to speak, the president silenced them, Dr. Fauci.
I'm not being muzzled. I was cleared here, and here I am talking to you, and I'll give you the whole truth the way I always have.
I've been talking about this for a while. They don't even have a test kit.
Well, we've already tested over 3,600 people here in the United States. I'm not sure what he meant when he said there's no lab kit.
You know, the idea that Donald Trump said just several days ago this was a Democratic hoax, what in God's name is he talking about? Has he no shame?
The Trump administration has been asleep at the wheel.
We know he doesn't have the capacity or the competence to handle such moments.
I cannot think of a worse person to put in charge of dealing with this coronavirus.
And his response has been pathetic.
This is not a Democratic hoax. This is incompetence on the part of the President of the United States.
And his incompetence really does put us all at risk.
President Trump, good morning. There's a pandemic of coronavirus. Where are you? Where is your plan?
Yeah, can you believe the way those people on Fox News Channel are politicizing coronavirus? because of the election. Can you believe how shameless those evil, rascally Republicans are? Every one of them, except for Dr. Fauci and whoever the other guy was who was refuting the lack of tests, is a Democrat in good standing with our media. And there they are, politicizing the coronavirus. It's almost as if Democrats lie or something. I know, I hope you were sitting down when I broke that news to you, but this is the world we live in. They're going to tell you up is down if they think they can get an advantage out of it. And our so-called champions of truth, the journalists, will not call them out on it at all because they're on the team. You guys remember, what was it, 2-3 years ago when they were, the left was going berserk and saying, we've got to get rid of all statues. Anybody who is Confederate, anybody who owned slaves, anybody who did this, that, and the other thing, we got to get rid of statues. And Donald Trump, it had to have been in 2016, because Donald Trump on the campaign trail said that they are going to go after, where do they go next? They go after the founding fathers. What do they do? Where does this stop? This whitewashing of history. It just so happened that all the statues of slave owners and Confederate heroes that they were wanting to get rid of were Democrats, and the Democratic Party didn't really want that on their record. They don't want people to know the history of their own party. Well, the left said, no, we're just getting rid of Civil War. We're not going to celebrate the Confederacy. We must not do that. That's where it is. That's where it belongs. I remember I was on the radio in Baltimore at the time, and overnight, 4 statues disappeared. It was a Confederate memorial, some Confederate generals, and a former Chief Justice, I believe, of the Supreme Court. He's definitely on the Supreme Court. Roger Taney, who wrote the majority opinion in the Dred Scott decision. They all disappeared. They all just disappeared overnight. Baltimore was in the midst of the most murders they'd ever had per capita by a long shot. And the mayor, who's now going to be going to prison for the next 3 years because she was scamming and using doing a get-rich-quick scheme, using her political position to force agencies that wanted favor with the government to enrich herself. They were just saying, buy 100,000 copies of my shitty child book, and you can have your contract, that sort of thing. And then she didn't pay tax, and it was a whole big mess. She's going away for 3 years. That mayor stood up and bravely and courageously got rid of, well, maybe it was the mayor before that, the one who fumbled the ball on the Freddie Gray case, whatever it was. They're worthless, string of worthless mayors, and they're all sort of blended together. Anyway, the mayor waved a magic wand and got rid of all the Confederate statues. 4 of them, big ones, disappeared overnight. And believe it or not, the murders in Baltimore continued. I don't know why. I don't know how. It's just kind of weird. It was as if the statues did not cause the murders and violence in the city at all. I was shocked, along with the rest of the city. But there was this argument at the time that where does this stop? Where does it end? Where does it go? Well, they said, no, this is it. We just want to get rid of this. Just like they said, this is only about gay marriage. This is it. It's just marriage. And now you've got twerking cross-dressers, quirking drag queens in front of 3-year-olds at story time in the public library. Like, oh, I thought it was just about getting married. That's weird. Washington Post has the story headline, Charlottesville won't celebrate Thomas Jefferson's birthday. It will mark slavery's end instead. Now, Thomas Jefferson is integral in the founding of the United States of America, and they're trying to wipe him off of history. The story, his name still adorns much of the city, from the public library to a private winery, at least for now. And from the foot of a mountain dedicated to him, his statue still gazes out over the university he founded. But lately, in ways both small and seismic, Thomas Jefferson's town has started to feel like it belongs to someone else. For the first time since World War II, Charlottesville won't honor the founding father's birthday this spring. Instead, on Tuesday, the city will celebrate the demise of the institution with which Jefferson increasingly has become associated. Slavery. Yes. Why has Jefferson been around associating himself with slavery more than he did when he was alive? And no, it's the radical left trying to rewrite history. They will define everybody by their worst attribute, their worst day, their worst whatever. Liberation and Freedom Day, as the new holiday is known, will commemorate when Union troops arrived here on March 3, 1865, and freed the enslaved people who made up the majority of Charlottesville's residents. The switch is the latest sign of a city struggling to come to grips with its past. How do you struggle to come to grips with your past? You didn't do it. You're a geographic location, okay? Get over yourselves. This generational guilt passed on drives me freaking nuts. You didn't do whatever your ancestors did, if your ancestors did anything bad at all. And quite frankly, the odds of your ancestors having owned slaves are next to none. There's a better odd that your ancestors were slaves at some point in your family's history, because at some point in human history, every group of people was a slave. Evil Whitey didn't create slavery. The United States did not create slavery, nor was it a bastion of slavery or the last place of slavery on the face of the earth. Slavery still exists today in Africa. In fact, that's the birthplace of slavery. Long before those mean, nasty Europeans came over, there were tribes enslaving other tribes. Capitalism in many ways got rid of the slavery as an institution. But that's neither here nor there. That's an argument for another time. But this garbage about all this group of historically marginalized people, get over yourselves, okay? Here's a little bit of truth for you. I hate to say it, you identity politics mutants. The people who ran the slave trade in Africa were Africans. African tribes were enslaving other tribes and bringing their prisoners as slaves to the coast and then selling them to the evil white Europeans. Nobody in this has clean hands. Nobody in this is good. You go back far enough in human history, and everybody, no matter what flavor of human being they happen to be, have done some horrible things. Your trying to deny it does not change its history, okay? Can you get over yourselves now? I don't think they can. I don't think they will. But it needs to be said, and it needs to be said often, and it needs to be said loudly by everybody more than just a podcast host who isn't afraid to piss liberals off. Somebody with some profile needs to step up and really take this ball and run with it, because sooner or later, they are going to go after everybody from the past. They are going to rewrite history. The New York Times is already trying to do it with their 1619 project. Oh, the very foundation of this country is slavery. The Revolutionary War was fought to protect the institution of slavery. Screw you. Get a damn life. You can't make a case for the future, so you're trying to change the past to change the present, to influence the present. You people are screwed in the head. There's something fundamentally wrong, and by wrong I mean evil, with the left. I could go on a rant, but I'm running out of time. As the last few minutes tick away, I want to say goodbye to Hardball with Chris Matthews. Chris Matthews last night said goodbye to his show. He resigned abruptly after more liberals went after him because he was critical of Bernie Sanders. So they began to nitpick. They began to get upset with him, and they targeted him, and they got him because the management over at MSNBC is beholden to the radical left. It's all who watch it. And if you lose them, nobody will watch. Here's Chris Matthews at the very start of his show. And this was the only time he appeared on the show. He then was replaced by Steve Kornacki, who hosted the rest of the show. Here's Chris Matthews saying goodbye.
Let me start with my headline tonight. I'm retiring. This is the last Hardball on MSNBC. And obviously, this isn't for lack of interest in politics. As you can tell, I've loved every minute of my 20 years as host of Hardball. Every morning I read the papers and I'm gung-ho to get to work. Not many people have had this privilege. I love working with my producers and the discussions we have over how to report the news. And I love having this connection with you, the good people who watch. I've learned who you are, bumping into you on the sidewalk or waiting at an airport and saying hello. You're like me. I hear it from your kids and grandchildren who say, my dad loves you, or my grandmother loves you, or my husband watched it till the end. Well, after a conversation with MSNBC, I decided tonight will be my last hardball. So let me tell you why. The younger generations out there are ready to take the reins. We see them in politics, in the media, in fighting for their causes. They are improving the workplace. We're talking here about better standards than we grew up with. Fair standards. A lot of it has to do with how we talk to each other. Compliments on a woman's appearance that some men, including me, might have once incorrectly thought were okay. We're never okay. Not then, and certainly not today. And for making such comments in the past, I'm sorry. I'm very proud of the work I've done here. Long before I went on television, I worked for years in politics, was a newspaper columnist, an author. I'm working on another book. I'll continue to write and talk about politics and cheer on my producers and crew here in Washington and New York and my MSNBC colleagues. They will continue to produce great journalism in the years ahead. And for those of you who have gotten in the habit of watching Hardball every night, I hope you're going to miss me because I'm going to miss you. But remembering Humphrey Bogart and Casablanca, we'll always have Hardball. So let's not say goodbye, but till we meet again.
In the late 90s and early, well, I guess I moved out here in 2001, so late 90s till 2001, I loved Hardball. I didn't have cable for a couple years because I couldn't afford it when I first moved out here, but I absolutely loved Hardball. I would watch it twice a day. It was on at either 5 or 6 o'clock and then on again at 11 o'clock, and most nights I would watch it twice. It was that good. It was honest. Chris Matthews wasn't an activist. He challenged everybody. It was like if Tim Russert had a show. Yeah, you knew he was liberal, but he was an honest liberal, and he would hold other liberals accountable when they tried to lie. Somewhere around 2003, 2004, things started to change, and the network started to change. By the time Barack Obama came along, the network that I could enjoy, that I did enjoy, was gone. It was done. And Chris Matthews was done and gone with it. The thrill up his leg, Chris Matthews, then dominated for the rest of his time at MSNBC and really tarnished the memories that people had of Hardball when it was the best political show on TV. When he would try to debate, Christopher Hitchens. That made me want to get to know Christopher Hitchens. I was lucky enough to get to know Christopher Hitchens, and it was all because of his appearances on Hardball that I wanted to get to know him. I miss the old Hardball. I forgot about the old Hardball. But him saying goodbye and him being chased out because he made a vague Nazi analogy about Bernie Sanders, that's what this is really about. And then another liberal journalist came out and said, he said I was pretty back then and I'm not pretty. And yeah, you're not on the inside, you're not. I don't know about your outsides. So they started to pile on. The left wanted Chris Matthews gone. The mob... as I always say, Frankenstein's monster always returns to the castle to burn it down. That's what happened with Hardball. Chris Matthews couldn't have been more on their team, but he wasn't 100% on their team. He still had that 0.1% where he would say things they didn't like, and that's not allowed. And that's why Chris Matthews was fired. He didn't retire. You don't retire and only get to say goodbye in a pre-recorded opening to your own show. That's not how it works in this business, not on a Tuesday. If you're retiring, you say, Friday will be my last show, and so we're going to say goodbye all week. When you're fired, you're allowed a pre-recorded goodbye. Chris Matthews was fired. I wish the show had never changed. I wish I could have still enjoyed it, but it just got to be so bad. I'll tell you, I would like to see... and I don't know who would have the balls to do it. Maybe Tucker. Maybe I'll shoot Tucker a text. I would like to see Chris Matthews on Fox. Not as a show, not at all, but as an occasional guest. Because I think he does know a lot. He's seen a lot. He follows this stuff. And they need more than the punching bag pinatas that they have over there. So I think that Chris Matthews with somebody like Tucker could really mix it up and make for interesting TV once again on cable news, just occasionally. I know it's too much to ask that cable news do news anymore or be interesting and hold honest debates anymore. But every once in a while, they might be able to pull off a segment, I hope. I'll shoot him a text. We'll see what he says. Anyway, that is all the time we have. Thank you for listening, tuning in, telling a friend. Website, patreon.com/DerekHunterPodcast if you want to help me out and help the show out, maintain the software and update the software and equipment and all that good stuff. Plus, you know, throw a couple of bucks in the tip jar or whatever. We'll know the results of Super Tuesday on Super Boring Wednesday, but we won't be boring, and we'll talk to you then. Have a great one.
We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men and women created by the, go, you know the thing.